What's going on, everybody? Welcome to episode 34 of the Data Driven Strength Podcast. Today, Zach and I are going to be diving into one specific topic today, and that is range of motion for hypertrophy training. So Zach recently did a webinar for our individualized programming group where he went into some recent studies in great detail. Today, he's going to briefly go through those, and then we're just going to kind of have a casual chat about the topic. As you guys will see, there's a lot of uncertainty here, still a lot to learn. So some good things to kind of speculate on, I think. Before I kick it over to Zach, if you would like to support what we do here, if you find value in the podcast, it'd be much appreciated if you can leave us a review on iTunes or Spotify, a rating or review, that is. Also, check out the description of this episode for things that we offer. I mentioned that individualized programming group. So that is a programming option we offer, as well as coaching as well. And you can also find the links to the mentioned studies in the description as well. All right, with that, Zach, I'll kick it over to you and let you kind of set the stage for this range of motion for hypertrophy discussion.
Yeah, man. So like you said, I was really excited to kind of dig into this literature for this past webinar for the IP group. This topic has gotten a lot of attention kind of just in social media and kind of on our sector of the lifting community in general. And it's something I haven't really been able to have a strong opinion on because I really haven't had a chance to work through the literature myself and kind of come to any firm conclusions. And so I was really excited to get a chance to do this. And so, like you said, I'm going to skim over these studies and I want to highlight it's a skim. There's a lot of details here that I covered in more depth in the webinar. So we're just going to kind of talk about them in generalities, some key points, and it's not going to be an all exhaustive conversation. So just keep that in mind on the front end, but we'll touch on some limitations and some important things to consider for this body of research kind of at the end. And I think that'll be probably something you definitely want to listen to just to make sure you get the full context of everything and not just the highlights of each study individually. So that's kind of the first piece of housekeeping on the front end. So, okay, what is this conversation that we're talking about in the first place? So when we're talking about range of motion, I think it's important to kind of get some definitions out of the way in the first place. So typically when we're talking about range of motion, we are talking about the total distance traveled on a repetition, generally from the starting position on a lift all the way to what I'm going to call the transition point. So basically when the eccentric and the concentric kind of end or start. Very simply, on a squat, that's going to be, you know, the start when you're completely locked out all the way down to right below parallel. Generally, that's kind of the range of motion of a repetition. Now, it's important to realize that that definition of range of motion has a few things that are kind of inherent to it. It's kind of something that needs to be defined kind of before you do the exercise, because theoretically I could look across the gym and seeing Josh doing some quarter squats. And depending on the goal that he's training for, the context in which he's performing that exercise, if he was specifically training quarter squats for some reason, that could be considered full range of motion in that context. So I think it's important just to realize that it's very specific to the demands that you're basically setting before you do the exercise. However, that said, I think the way that we want to define it for this conversation, specifically for training for muscle growth, can probably be, you know, boiled down to the range of motion at a joint. And generally that's going to be corresponding to the range of motion of a muscle group that we care to train. So coming back to the example of squat, you know, if we're talking generally in the strength context, a full range of motion squat is going to be when you kind of go below parallel. And that's really all we care about. However, when we transfer that to hypertrophy training, we're training for muscle growth. Specifically, what we're talking about is the range of motion at the knee or the amount of knee flexion that we're getting. So just because you're going below parallel doesn't mean you're necessarily getting as much knee flexion as possible. So there could be additional range of motion to be had. So I think that's probably the most useful way to define it for hypertrophy. And that's kind of how we're going to use it for this upcoming discussion. In addition to that, there's kind of two concepts that we probably need to define as well that we think are probably the most interesting kind of pieces of this research when we kind of try to take away some nuggets and things to think about. And so the first one would be muscle length. So when you hear the concept of muscle length, what that means is a muscle has kind of a I'm going to call it a maximum practical stretch that you can kind of reach when you're training. So there is some position in which you can do in the gym or some exercise, I suppose you could think about it that way, that's going to put that muscle at its most stretched position. That is kind of the maximal muscle length that you would want to think about a muscle reaching. And so some exercises will train a muscle at a longer length than others. Very easy example for that is if I think about a quarter squat versus a squat. I think it's come back to that example. I think it's pretty easy because the quads go across or control the knee joint for the most part. If I go into more knee flexion, that is going to result in the quads being trained at a longer muscle length. So that's kind of the first thing to talk about. Muscle length kind of refers to the degree of stretch in reference to a muscle's maximum practical kind of stretch that we can do in the gym. The other thing that we want to kind of define on the front end here is what I'm going to call the failing range of motion. And so what that means is in certain exercises, you're going to fail at a different portion of the range of motion. This is going to be predominantly dictated based on the biomechanics of an exercise when moment arms are the longest and you're the least mechanically efficient. And so if we just think about another easy example, let's say I'm squatting two parallel, so 90 degrees of knee flexion, and I'm doing a leg extension machine that also starts me at 90 degrees of knee flexions. The total range of motion is the same, you know, 90 to 180, and then, so those are the same. However, the squat, you are likely going to fail a repetition in the bottom of the squat when the quads are in that more stretched position. Whereas a leg extension, at least most leg extension machines, you're going to fail it when your quad is in that contracted position. And so that is where the failing range of motion may differ. But once again, it's important to define range of motion on the front end because you still need to understand how that fits in to the overall piece and the overall muscle length as well. But those are kind of the two important concepts we're going to touch on in this research, as we think those are the kind of two things we're trying to kind of stack up with these studies to see what is really driving some of the observations that we see in these studies. Okay. So really quick, go ahead, Josh.
Yeah. Just two super quick points. The first thing I'll mention is that not all muscles are created equal in terms of muscle lengths that they can be exposed to. Just the degree of absolute stretch, if you will, that a muscle A can undergo compared to muscle B, just based on anatomical constraints, is going to be different. So it's important to remember that each study or each muscle probably has its own unique considerations, some of which we might be aware of, some of which we might not be aware of. And because there's so little research on this topic, that's important to keep in mind. So I agree with obviously Zach's kind of main things or main variables to point out here in terms of the muscle length that the movement exposes the muscle to, as well as the failure point. However, I do want to point out that like there are kind of these additional nuanced considerations when you get down to exercise selection on a muscle to muscle basis. That's the first thing. The second thing I'll say is, because I think those two points are really important to keep in mind, maybe Zach, while you go through these few studies, once you're done with each one, I'll quickly recap those two variables for the listener just to kind of bring it home. That way they can kind of obviously listen to the brief details you give about the study. Then I can just kind of sum up, make sure everyone's on the same page and move on. Again, we'll kind of go through these pretty rapid fire though.
Cool. Yeah, it sounds good. Just to hammer home the first one you said, that's why I was saying practical kind of muscle length or degree of stretch, because like Josh said, you got different things, you know, different structures, bony structures, that things like that, that can influence the degree of stretch a muscle may be able to experience in reference to, like, if we were going to take a cadaver and try to stretch a muscle, that you could probably get to a different conclusion there when you don't have to worry about some of the constraints of a human in real life.
Yeah. Like this is bro science. I'm not going to act like I know much about this, or I've read, like, I don't know, cadaver studies or, you know, just dove into any literature that would be relevant to this, but like the lateral delts are just much harder to get like a really gnarly stretch on compared to the hamstrings, for example. Again, I don't really know how to describe that, but I think the listener intuitively knows what I'm saying, and that's kind of a consideration as well. But nonetheless, yeah. I think we can move forward.
For sure. Yep. Cool. Okay. So what is kind of the reason we're getting to this kind of conversation in the first place? So I just want to briefly recap how this conversation has kind of went in the past and why we are discussing this in the first place. So you very often have probably heard people talk about how full range of motion is superior for hypertrophy in comparison to partial range of motion. For the most part, I think that's going to lead to sound practical conclusions, but there's definitely some more nuance to be had there. So there was a meta-analysis recently by Polares and colleagues that kind of look at range of motion and its effect on muscle growth. And they saw a significant effect for lower limb muscle growth for full range of motion in comparison to partial range of motion. However, in reference to that meta-analysis, there was actually a letter to the editor that was written called Partial Range of Motion and Muscle Hypertrophy, Not All Range of Motions Lead to Rome. I really like that title. That's why I wanted to read it. But all basically they were getting at was that while pooling these studies of full range of motion versus partial range of motion may result in full range of motion seeming to be far superior for muscle growth, there is additional factors, specifically the muscle length that is which being trained may make partials something that isn't just able to be grouped all together. There's some additional nuance there. But ultimately, the reason that's relevant is I'm going to talk about some studies that have been published since that meta-analysis came out to kind of add some additional context there. Not going to really touch on any older studies, but we're just going to briefly talk about some of the newer ones that really bring this topic to the forefront. Okay, so kind of got five studies that, like Josh said, we're going to kind of hit rapid fire here, and we'll kind of recap them one by one. So the first one, we have a meta-analysis by Aranchuk and colleagues in 2018. So what they were doing was they were looking at three studies, which is why meta-analysis is a little bit, you know, maybe it's a little bit a gracious, gracious title. Yeah. But anyway, so what they were looking at was the effects of isometric training. So important to keep in mind there, isometric training is when you're pushing against an implement as hard as you can, but it doesn't move. And they just looked at different joint angles, which ultimately results in some conditions training at a longer muscle length and some conditions training at a shorter muscle length. And they saw that training at a longer muscle length seemed to lead to meaningfully greater muscle growth. And so what this does is kind of adds a point in favor of the column that while range of motion seems to be important, independent of range of motion, muscle length seems to be a meaningful factor that it, when manipulated, seems to at least modify muscle growth quite a bit. That said, this of course doesn't really mimic standard hypertrophy training. It's really just to kind of get the conversation started to say, oh, this is really interesting. When we perform isometric training and we're technically not performing any range of motion, but we manipulate the muscle length in which those isometrics occur, muscle growth seems to be meaningfully impacted. So that's kind of to get this conversation of these two factors between muscle length and failure point kind of happening and kind of gets the ball rolling. Of course, with isometric training, technically the failure point would also be manipulated. So that's important to keep in mind, but this is kind of how the authors framed it. It was more so at the muscle length conversation. But Josh, you want to add anything to that one?
Yeah. So let's focus on the two variables of muscle length and failure point. Let's go ahead and also add in total range of motion, right? Because I think this one is relevant because people just kind of associate, oh, longer range of motion is better. Sure. I'm going to choose this movement over the other because it has a larger absolute range of motion, which may or may not be a huge factor, right? So we'll kind of investigate that. So in this, we'll just kind of sum up these three studies from this meta-analysis. So muscle length, based on this, a training at a longer muscle length in an isometric sense, at least, leads to greater hypertrophy. And then failure point, because it's isometrics, training at a muscle length at a failure point that is a longer muscle length seems to be beneficial. Obviously you can't tease those out though in this context. And then total range of motion is literally zero, right? And again, to be clear from these studies, we're not saying that, muscle length or failure point is what's driving all gains because we see that total range of motion was zero here, right? We can't say that for sure from these studies because they don't compare it to other studies that have, you know, longer ranges of motion or any range of motion, right? But again, in this case, muscle length and failure point at a, if they're longer, then that seems to be beneficial, but obviously there's going to be more nuance in the later studies.
Cool. Yep. I agree. All right. Moving to number two here. This was a recent study by Mayo and colleagues that looked at hamstring training, specifically with either seated or prone hamstring curls and the effect of muscle growth with that. So specifically, this was a within subject design. So that's a huge advantage. They split up a participant to one leg kind of performing this prone hamstring curl and one leg performing the seated hamstring curl. And without, you know, like I said, going into excessive detail here, basically they looked at a ton of different sites, three of which we would expect if training at longer muscle lengths was going to lead to greater muscle growth, they would be experience greater muscle growth with the seated hamstring curl. One site we would think would lead to greater muscle growth with the prone hamstring curl, and two sites that really don't seem to be impacted by the degree of hip flexion. That is ultimately what the difference between the seated and the prone leg curl world, because they both use the exact same total range of motion. And those two didn't really seem to be impacted by the hip flexion. So when we actually look at the results, pretty much matches up exactly what we would think based on that hypothesis from the functional anatomy. Three of the sites saw greater muscle growth with this seated leg curl. One site was greater with the prone leg curl, and the two sites that really don't change muscle length based on the degree of hip flexion didn't really see any differences. So this seems to be relatively strong evidence to say that muscle length seems to be an important factor here. Now, important to state with this one, based on the description of the exercise, I can't say with 100% confidence what the failing range of motion is. So we can't really be sure about that. However, based on our experience with hamstring curl machines, I would imagine it's very similar. So I would say this is a decent design to kind of investigate the effects of muscle length with a fixed total range of motion in presumably a fixed failure point.
Yep, exactly. So as far as we can tell, it looks like muscle length was kind of isolated here, or at least the muscle length it was exposed to, right? Because the muscle length of the failure point is likely similar. Again, we don't know for sure, right? Different hamstring curls are different and can be very different, right? Yeah. But to kind of sum up from our variables, so total range of motion, more or less the same. Failure point, the muscle length at the failure point, more or less the same. And then muscle length was longer in the seated hamstring group for at least a few of the sites or most of the sites. And that led to greater muscle growth in those sites. So again, this study kind of isolates the muscle length it's exposed to, and it kind of indicates that exposing yourself to a longer muscle length leads to greater hypertrophy.
Yep. Cool. All right, moving on to the next one. This one's by Nunez and colleagues in 2020. So this one was a biceps curl study where they were training preacher curls with either a cable or like an easy bar barbell. And so the important thing here is because the shoulder is fixed on the preacher curl pad, the muscle length being trained would theoretically be the exact same. The only difference would be based on the implement utilized, the muscle length that the rep would be the most challenging, or that failure point would be difference between the two different implements. The cable, because the cable was like slightly in front of them, they had a picture in this in the paper, it would presumably be the most challenging up towards the contracted position of the curl, up towards your face. Whereas the barbell, because it's acting against gravity, is going to be much more challenging at a longer muscle length. Now, when we look at the results here, there actually was pretty much zero difference between the two groups, suggesting that to some degree, at a fixed muscle length, but a different failure point, one occurring at a longer muscle length and one occurring at a shorter muscle length, that didn't really seem to impact results. So comparing this with kind of the other couple of studies that we have, it seems that we could tentatively say muscle length may be a little bit more predictive of changes in muscle growth than the failure point. That said, we'll talk about this in the end. The site in which we measure the muscle thickness or the muscle growth changes is probably pretty important here. Like I said, we'll touch on that when we kind of get to the limitations and just kind of some discussion points. But Josh, I don't know if you have anything to add on that one.
Nope. So this is, again, similar to the previous study, and that total range of motion was similar. But this time, muscle length was similar, or the muscle length that the each of the movements were exposed to. But the muscle length at the failure point was longer in the easy bar preacher curl compared to the cable preacher curl, but that did not lead to differences in growth. So kind of at this point, it seems like the muscle length, just from the studies we've looked at so far, the muscle length you were exposed to, but not necessarily the muscle length you fail at, seems to matter a little bit more, but it's not quite that neat once we dive into these next few studies.
Yep. And that's what I was going to say. This next one's probably the most complex one to kind of dig into. So this is a study by Pedrosa and colleagues. And what they did is they had four different training groups. There was a fifth group that was non-training control. Not going to touch on that. So just four different training groups. And I think it's important to start with the full range of motion group. So they had one group performing full range of motion leg extensions. Then they had an initial group that, for sake of simplicity, they did the first half of the repetition, but they did not lock it out. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm thinking about this study. What do you think about just talking about the initial versus the full group? I feel like those are that's probably the comparison that's most relevant to this discussion, unless you disagree.
Yep. I'll just add two pieces of context at the end, but yes, we'll do that. So yes, for sake of simplicity, we're going to compare the full range of motion group. So one group completely performing full reps versus a group that only performed basically the first half of that rep. So two things that are important here. Both of the groups are being exposed to the same muscle length because they're getting the same bottom range of motion or the same maximum amount of knee flexion and repetition. However, based on the way that the repetitions were performed, the group only performing the first half of the rep would also fail at a longer muscle length. When we look at the results here, they looked at two muscles along four different lengths of the quadriceps. Basically, they saw that the group performing the first half of the repetition beat out the full range of motion group in most cases. And so tentatively, that suggests that maybe it's not just the muscle length. Muscle length is important and probably is the most driving factor, because when we bring in those other couple of groups, all of those kind of seem to beat out the group only performing the top half of the repetition, which is another one of the groups. So when we kind of compare, including the exposures to the long muscle length versus not, that still held true. But if we're exposing two groups to long muscle lengths, maybe the failure point does matter a little bit, at least in this context. I don't know if you think that's a fair kind of summary there, Josh.
Yeah, I think that's good. So if we kind of focus on our three variables, again, let's focus on that initial group that basically did the bottom half of the leg extension, right? So the more stretched portion of the leg extension compared to the full group that did that bottom half as well as the top half as well, right? So in terms of the muscle length they were exposed to, it was the same, right? They both had the same bottom end of the range of motion, right? And then in terms of the muscle length at the failure point, it was long, the muscle length at the failure point was longer in the initial group, right? But interestingly, total range of motion was less in the initial group, right? Because the number of sets and reps were equated. But the initial group still, you know, results in terms of hypertrophy leaned in favor of the initial group. So in this case, it appears that the muscle length at the failure point is pretty dang important, which again, kind of makes the results up to this point when compiling all these studies a little bit more complicated. Do you think that's a fair summary, Zach?
Yeah. And I think it's even you can, it's not the exact same, but I think you can kind of double down on that a little bit when you include the varied group as well. So the varied group did both the initial training, so like kind of some training at the first half of the reps, but they also did some of the training at only the second half of the reps, and they generally still saw better growth than the full range of motion group. So they were being exposed to long muscle lengths some of the time, but not as much as the full range of motion group, actually.
Right.
But they also were failing in that that lengthened portion some of the time. So yeah, that's an interesting thing to consider as well, to add a little bit more context. But this is really the only study that kind of conclusively shows that, I think, out of this group. So we'll kind of bring us all together at the end here. But this one definitely adds a little bit of support to the failure point at a longer muscle length being important to some degree.
Yeah. Again, we promised not to be too detailed with the study reviews, but it probably is important to note that the way their analyses were presented did make it a little bit tough to be super confident in these conclusions.
Yep.
And just overall, like, take everything we're talking about with a grain of salt, because it's so hard to put all these together, because I just have so many other thoughts that we just don't have time to go into. I'll just throw two of them out there super quickly. The first thing is that the muscle length, even in that initial group, the quote unquote long muscle length, was not that long, right? It's the bottom of a leg extension, right? It's not that stretched. Think about like a single leg squat where you're literally bringing your hamstring to your calf. That's what most people think of as a long muscle length, right? We're comparing like kind of short to like really short, basically, in this study. Also, like the study designs are another consideration. In this study specifically, if I recall correctly, the group training, the initial group training the longer muscle length, they used heavier loads, right? Which was necessary in order for the failure point with the same number of sets and reps to be lower, right? So there's just a ton that goes into this that, you know, we could go on for hours talking about, but hopefully you guys are kind of following along up to this point in terms of our main three variables though.
I don't want to belabor this too much. I'm just going to say two more things. This is more of an idea generating conversation more than it is. This is not prescriptive, I don't think. This is way more about, hey, this stuff's interesting. It's really in its infancy as a body of research, actually like examining this question specifically. So it's pretty cool. And we can probably, you know, try a few of these things out in our training, but definitely would not overhaul things based on anything we're saying here. So just adding that up, but I'm going to touch on this last study and then we can continue to ramble on the limitations.
We'll talk about the limitations. Hopefully we'll provide a little bit of practical take home. Some broad stroking. Broad strokes.
Absolutely.
Cause that's what we're looking for in the research is not exactly how to train the leg extension in terms of sets, reps and range of motion, all that stuff, but just these general concepts to bring them into practice within the individual in front of you. So anyway, I think we've made our point. Cool.
Yeah. Idea fuel. Okay. Last one. Recent study by Sato and colleagues. So basically this study trained only one arm on the preacher. I can't remember the implement. It's a preacher curl of some kind. I think it was with a dumbbell in training.
It was with a dumbbell.
Yeah. Okay. And so
90% sure.
I'm pretty sure. I honestly can't remember, but I'm pretty sure. Okay. And so what they did in this one was they had one group that performed their training, which was 50 degrees in total at a long muscle length, and another group that also did 50 degrees of total range of motion at a short muscle length. And they assigned a load to be relative to the most challenging part of each of the group's range of motions respectively. And so what that resulted in is the group training at longer muscle lengths, meaning they're training their biceps with more stretch, also would fail at a longer muscle length. So again, here we have total range of motion fixed, but both muscle length exposure and the failing point range muscle length, both are being manipulated here.
Can I clarify something on that? So I'm imagining a dumbbell preacher curl, right? And if you're doing the bottom 50 degrees, right? So from fully extended arm up and not quite up until halfway, right? Just those bottom 50 degrees. The failure point would be at the top of that, right? So like around like a little under a third of the way up of a curl. And then if you're doing the top 50%, right? So basically the point of full arm flexion down 50 degrees, you're failing about two thirds of the way up. So the failure point would actually be slightly different unless I'm mistaken.
No, that's what I said. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Cool. Yeah, that's what I said. Yeah. The long muscle length group would simultaneously be training at exposures to longer muscle lengths, but also failing at longer muscle lengths. So two factors are being manipulated.
I probably just heard you wrong because trying to make this little table to like, while you're talking.
Nice.
So yeah, proceed. Just want to clarify.
Yep. No worries. Cool. So basically what they found here, and so they measured the biceps muscle thickness at a few different sites. We're going to come back to this. Some more proximal up towards your shoulder and some more distal down towards your, the crook of your elbow. And basically they saw that when you average all of those sites together, the group training and failing at longer muscle lengths generally saw greater growth, than the other group. But this was definitely more pronounced at the distal sites in comparison to the proximal sites, which again, we're going to discuss here in a second. But as Josh likes to make this table, just to recap, range of motion, same. Total range of motion, at least. Muscle length exposure. One group is training at longer muscle lengths than the other, and they also failed at a longer muscle length in comparison to the other group. Thus, kind of got two factors being manipulated there, but the group training and failing at longer muscle lengths saw greater growth.
Nice.
Cool. Okay.
So let's briefly go through these four studies.
Yep.
And I hope I don't, unless Zach, do you have anything else to say on that last one?
No.
Cool. So hopefully I don't butcher any of these authors' names. So the first one is the Mayo study. And that was the hamstring curl study, right? Prone versus seated leg curl. Prone versus seated leg curl. And the general conclusion there, focusing on our variables, is that exposure to a longer muscle length is beneficial, but not necessarily the failure point. Now let's go to the Nunez study, which compared cable preacher curl to easy bar preacher curl. And the general take home, again, focusing on our variables there, is that failing at a longer muscle length did not necessarily help hypertrophy, right? And they were also exposed to the same muscle lengths. Then we have the Pedrosa leg extension study. And the general take home there is that the failure point being at a longer muscle length did help muscle growth, did lead to faster rates of muscle growth. Finally, we have the Sato study, which was the dumbbell preacher curl bottom half versus, or bottom third compared to top third. And they found that the group training in the bottom third saw greater muscle growth, and that was a longer muscle length that they were exposed to, and also a longer muscle length that they failed at. So not a super clear picture. We have a little bit of conflicting evidence here in terms of our variables.
Yep. No, totally agree. I think it's tough to say conclusively what the kind of picture is here. I think, like you said, one of the biggest things that just really I'm thinking through more on the spot here is when we have those two studies that are better able to isolate the failure point question, the Nunez study, that's more along training the biceps in that stretch position that I think about. Whereas the Pedrosa study is more in that moderate range. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder how that impacts things there. If the failure point does matter, if you're not reaching what we would generally consider in training to be a mm-hmm. actually stretch position. If we actually reach that stretch position, more so in that Nunez study with the bicep curl, at least at the elbow, of course, if you want to really stretch out the biceps, you would want to, put your arm behind your torso, like an incline curl. But nonetheless, a similar concept here, that the failure point didn't seem to matter. So I wonder if that right. is part of the equation there, insofar as if you're not able to make an exercise stretch the muscle pretty well, probably should try to make it fail at its longest exposure, at least within that movement, if that makes sense. You agree with that, Josh?
Yeah. So kind of what you're saying, of course. Yeah. So the Nunez paper and the Pedrosa study, both more or less isolated, again, very, very much more or less isolated the muscle length of the failure point. In the Nunez study, we saw that failing at a longer muscle length didn't matter. But in the Pedrosa study, we saw that it failing at a longer muscle length did help. And what you're saying is that now I'm kind of losing my train of thought here. So tell me exactly what you're saying.
Basically I'm saying in the leg extension study.
Yeah.
Like you said, you were the one that brought this up. That isn't really what I like, the range of motion specifically in that study isn't exactly what I think of when I think stretched quad position. Mm. It's more in that mid range. So
I got my train of thought back. So if it's a exercise that you aren't getting to a very stretched position, you probably want to get to as stretched of a position as possible within the constraints of that exercise.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that makes sense. And honestly, just my general take, and Zach, obviously while you were making this webinar, you've gone through these a little bit more recently than me, but I've read all these studies kind of as they came out. So it's been a little bit, but just kind of my general thought process has always been that it appears that the muscle length you're exposed to seems to matter a little bit more. And if you kind of remove that Pedrosa study, that is kind of the picture you see. But with the Pedrosa study, it's just not long muscle length. So it's like, hey, if it's not long muscle lengths, just get as long as you can, and that'll probably help. Mm-hmm. Because, if you think about a leg extension, it's so easy at the bottom And that's like long for the, that's like a long muscle length for the leg extension, which isn't really that long. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that's kind of where I'm leaning. And that would just be my general approach, would be focus on the muscle length that it's exposed to in general on a per set basis, exposing a muscle to a longer muscle length throughout the range of motion. So long as it's somewhat difficult in that range of motion, you're probably going to, you know, be checking that box. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. The only other variable that, again, I'm just kind of coming up with counter arguments to myself as I'm sitting here, is that the Pedrosa study also is manipulating total range of motion. So you can make the argument that their performance was more localized to the range of motion that we suspect is the most, you know, substantial in terms of growth. So maybe I still think if we're going to take a step back and have some sort of kind of mental picture, I think I agree with you, is that basically we don't know if there's diminishing returns to the degree of muscle length. Like, do you need to be absolutely hamstrings touching your calves for your quads? Is that going to be the best? Or is there a little bit before that that's going to get the job done and maybe isn't going to result as much soreness, maybe it's not much fatigue, and that ultimately is a net positive? We don't know that. I think the isometric study is interesting because it does seem to at least conclude, like somewhat paint that dose response picture, but three studies, man, let's calm down. It's just that is somewhat interesting as far as that goes. But
and
again,
not super ecologically valid.
Yeah. Tons of problems. So, and it doesn't separate muscle length and failure point in that. Yeah. So it's very hard to say, but, nonetheless, I think your mental model kind of makes sense to me, in that kind of the primary factor we're concerned with is let's get that muscle in a stretch position. That don't take it to an absolutely crazy degree, like still perform the exercises that seem to be kind of tried and tested for the most part, but maybe try to get that little extra stretch. And so long as the failure point is roughly around that more stretch position, I think you're going to be in the ballpark, as opposed to making, you know, concessions potentially on the degree of stretch to make the failure point at the longest muscle length within the movement. I think that probably makes the most sense to me as of now.
Yeah. So if you're doing a leg extension that's hardest at the top, on a per set basis, I think this is pretty good. Like, just our kind of mental model here, I feel pretty confident saying that that's going to be, on a per set basis, quite worse than at least exposing yourself to a longer muscle length where it's at least somewhat difficult. Just because, again, you're really not getting exposed to a stretched position at all. And you can also extrapolate that to other exercises, right? Something like a dumbbell lateral raise. You're really not exposing yourself to much tension in a stretched position at all. Now, then you get to the caveat that all of these studies are kind of looking at this concept on a per set basis, right? In general, if you're doing like a cable lateral raise where it's really hard at the bottom compared to a dumbbell lateral raise where it's really hard at the top, right? That failure point is different. In general, you can do dumbbell lateral raises like 2-0 RAR until the cows come home. Whereas those cable lateral raises, those are a little bit more fatiguing, subjectively seem to cause a little bit more muscle damage. So then you start to think about like this fatigue matched concept, right? Okay. Yeah. Maybe cable lateral raises are better on a per set basis, but what if I can do three times as many dumbbell lateral raise sets? Maybe that's actually a net positive, right? So I think, you know, that's just another layer to add on there. But yeah, I don't know if you have anything to.
No, yeah. I mean, that's interesting. The other thing that comes to mind to me is that, sure, on a per set basis, you know, exposing yourself to longer muscle lengths may be beneficial for overall hypertrophy. But I think there's indications, at least here, that this may also happen at a regional specific manner. And so just looking at the few studies that do tend to measure multiple sites, training at longer muscle lengths generally seems to even have a even greater kind of advantage at distal sites. And what I think is interesting is that while the training at the long muscle lengths wasn't worse, it didn't really have an advantage, if we go back to that Pedrosa study, at the most proximal site, even in comparison to the group only training that final part of the range of motion. And so ultimately what I'm getting at there is, there really only is one study that doesn't look at this in a black and white fashion. And I don't think that's how you should apply it either. I think, you know, based on what we have, the bulk of your sets should probably have this concept in mind, in the sense that if we can get a bigger bang for our buck and be efficient with the stimulus, I think that probably makes sense to make a majority of your sets come from exercises that are going to train the muscles at a long length. However, if there are regional specific responses to training a muscle at a short length, don't just completely throw that tool out. Like, maybe that's a reason to keep those exercises in your program, to make sure that we're challenging the muscle across all points in its range of motion, in terms of failure point or even just exposure. And I think that that's important to keep in mind. And then also what you were saying about just being able to accumulate more work, I think that's something I see all the time in strength athletes, people who do a ton of long muscle length type movements, you know, bench, squat. A lot of times when I'm trying to introduce more training stress, I intentionally utilize exercises that do not train the muscle at a long length, because anecdotally, like you said, less soreness, less fatigue, less mental fatigue as well. Like, it just, for whatever reason, doesn't seem to be as challenging. This is also something else we said. We said generally stuff that's challenging at a short muscle length just feels like it's effective. So like, you get kind of that mental high when you leave the gym and you're like, oh man, those chest flies really were stimulative, even though theoretically, based on what we know here, actually maybe it's the opposite. But I think I consider that stuff that's shorter muscle length failure point to be low cost training volume. And I think that's something to definitely not just throw out, and just keep in mind that this really has not been examined in a more blended approach that we would likely take in practice. And so again, principles, not methods, from research, to keep that in mind. So I don't know if you have anything there, Josh.
Yeah. Kind of on that same point of the utility of each of these general, if we were to kind of categorize every exercise into one of two buckets, right? Whether it's kind of this more lengthened bias, versus more shortened biased. Again, obviously there's more nuance there in terms of muscle length that's exposed to versus muscle length of failure point, but let's just think in two broad categories right now. Arguably there could be the possibility that exposing yourself to both will lead to more quote unquote well-rounded hypertrophy across the entire length of a muscle belly, right? In that Sato study, I don't have the data right in front of me, but the differences at the distal portion, like Zach said, so closer to the elbow, were so much larger, right? Compared to the magnitude of difference closer up towards the shoulder. So arguably, there could be the possibility that if you do some shortened bias bicep exercises and you do more sets of them, you'll see more. You'll see a greater magnitude of proximal bicep growth. And then you do your more lengthened bias ones and you get that distal growth, maybe have to do less sets, that kind of thing. Again, as far as I'm aware, none of these studies show worse proximal growth from the longer muscle length exercises. However, that could be a possibility if you do more volume of the shortened bias exercises. So again, that's honestly my mental model in terms of, like, if I have someone that has a hypertrophy goal, and is, you know, looking to maximize hypertrophy of a specific muscle, I don't really see a downside to including both of them. Right. The next thing on that point is, it does seem like the exercises that either expose the muscle to a longer muscle length or have a, longer muscle length at the failure point are also more fatiguing. Right. So for that reason, it can be really helpful within microcycle design in terms of when you're spacing out your exercises. Right. And I do this all the time. Right. If someone is training quads 3 times per week and maybe they can't do like a, or maybe Friday, right. Let's say they're training quads Monday, Wednesday, Friday. If Friday is their heaviest session of the week, you better believe we're not doing like some super deep split squats that are like maximum knee flexion, which also have a pretty long muscle length at the failure point on Wednesday, right? Because they're going to come into Friday pretty with a good amount of muscle damage in those quads. So you can also leverage that there. Okay, that's when we're going to kind of sprinkle in our leg extensions that are hardest at the top. We can probably push those to 0 or 1 RIR and probably be fine by Friday, not really run into any issues, at least for most people. And again, like you said, that's kind of low cost volume. So again, it's not that one is better or worse on a per set basis, kind of the, that general category of longer muscle lengths, probably quote unquote better, but they both have utility and they arguably will be better together than if you were to just go one route or the other. So yeah, I have a couple of other thoughts not related to that, but I'll see if you have anything to respond to there.
Yeah, I don't really think I have much there. I was just gonna bring up the next kind of thing to keep in mind too. I was just gonna double down on the fact that, so technically, based on the stuff we've talked about today, really I'm only examining the quads, biceps, and then hamstrings with only literally one study. So just really important to keep in mind. There's a lot of factors that undergo the architecture of individual muscles that could make them operate differently on some of these concepts. And just, we only can really be confident about the muscles that have been examined. And even within those, the methods aren't super consistent and clean to have super strong conclusions. So again, I just want to double down on the fact that really only a few muscles have been examined here. So I don't even know if this is going to generalize to the chest, the back, things like that. It just really hasn't been studied well. Again, I think I view this as idea fuel, and you want to give, you know, some of your training program a shot with these kind of principles in mind and see how progression trends with the inclusion with that. That's how I would kind of view this stuff, as opposed to saying, oh, okay, I listened to this podcast and I have to rewrite my training program tomorrow with all of these things in mind because science says so. I don't think that's the approach to take, and just really understanding this is probably to some degree, at least, muscle dependent. Or at least we don't know anything other than the quads, biceps, and hamstrings with the single study.
Right. So let's assume, just as a thought experiment, let's assume kind of our conjecture based on the research that the muscle length you're exposed to is more important than the muscle length at the failure point. Or I should say that a little bit differently. The muscle length you're exposed to is the driver as opposed to the failure, the driver of greater growth as opposed to the muscle length at the failure point. If that's the case, I just think that that's an interesting concept to think about in its relationship to proximity to failure. Because when we talk about proximity to failure and we're like, hey, okay, yeah, 0 to 4 RIR, that's a really good practical recommendation, but I think you're probably taking options off the table. I think that this is a good example of, like, at the end of the day, if you're able to simply expose the target muscle to a longer muscle length, but not necessarily reach failure there and still maximize growth, that is kind of an indication of proximity to failure almost along the range of motion, that like proximity to failure isn't necessarily driving the hypertrophy outcomes. Does the way I think you know what I'm talking about, Zach? Does the way I explain that make sense?
Yeah, it's tough. I know what you're saying. I obviously the basic concept of what Josh is getting at is the muscle length, the fact, like, just let me paint a practical example. Maybe that'll help. One thing that we've never had somebody fight us on when we talk about the proximity to failure stuff is RDLs. No one actually takes RDLs to 0 to 1 RIR. At least I don't think I've ever seen that. If you do a set of RDLs with 5 reps in reserve, a true 5 reps in reserve, like we always talk about, making sure the RIR is accurate, I think most people are still absolutely trashed the next day. And in most cases, that's probably because the hamstrings in that exercise, if performed adequately, are at a really long length. And so basically what Josh is getting at there, to some degree, if I was understanding your point, muscle length probably modifies that proximity to failure relationship a good degree. And yeah, theoretically, if some of these studies are not reaching failure, yet exposing themselves to long muscle lengths and seeing robust growth, that could be kind of an indication the other way around as well. I would say I'd probably sit more on the side of, personally, on the side of, I just think the muscle length probably influences the proximity failure necessary to maximize the per set stimulus. I'd probably say that's where I'm at, but I think I understood your point.
Yeah. Like, I'd say the practical take home, or my opinion would be that if you're to frame hypertrophy training as driven by proximity to failure, that's where I take issue with it. Where I would kind of push back. And I think this again, this research is still a lot left to be determined, but I think this is kind of a decent example to indicate that proximity to failure is more just like a general threshold you need to make sure you're within the ballpark of. And like you said, that's going to be modulated by other factors. In this case, muscle length that you're exposed to. But yeah, I think we kind of made our point there, Zach, unless you have something to add.
I'll move on to
the next one.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to bring one up unless you want to keep going.
Nah, go for it, man.
So polite. You guys didn't see his face. Oh, yeah, I guess you will see his face. He was very hesitant there. The other thing I wanted to bring up was, you know, a pretty big limitation of this line of research as far as the individuals are looking to generalize these findings to is all of these subjects, all these studies, I think, included untrained subjects. So obviously, that's a pretty big confounder. And especially for muscle growth studies that are very strongly influenced by, you know, genetics, nutrition, stuff you do outside of the study. All studies are, of course, but specifically muscle growth. We can control for that better with a within subjects design. And most of these studies use a between subjects design. And so maybe one of the groups, they go out and have terrible nutrition, terrible sleep, whereas the other group didn't. And there's just additional factors in addition to the training that can influence the results there. So a lot of these... Go ahead.
Theoretically, the randomization takes care of that, but we know that. Yeah, we know that.
Of course.
Yeah, within relatively small sample research in this field, like that's always a possibility. Basically, what you're saying is, you know, arguably within subjects designs where one leg is on one protocol, the other is on another protocol, that kind of controls for things would arguably be a little bit better. I just wanted to say that because I know technically, like the randomization would theoretically take care of that. So,
yep. Theoretically.
Underlined. Theoretically. Okay.
Yeah. So keeping that in mind is important when we talk about this stuff. I think you could get away with untrained subjects if you use a lot as a within subject design, but I think stacking those two things on top of one another probably makes me have some caution in generalizing these things for muscle growth particularly. So that's just another thing to keep in mind is that this could be different with trained subjects. Simply don't know. Hasn't really been investigated. So that's just, you know, another thing to keep in mind, because one thing I've heard that I do think is interesting is part of this response potentially is just exposures to novel ranges of motion rather than something that's actually manipulated by training. So if you're an undertrained individual and you've never really gone to extreme ranges of motion and you really live your entire life in these kind of moderate muscle lengths and daily activities of living is that's really all you do. If you come into a study and expose yourself to an extreme position, that probably, and usually that's going to be a longer length rather than a shorter length in most cases. That may be part of the reason that there's just considerably greater muscle growth, especially at those distal sites. Potentially that is another thing to keep in mind and why I think maybe the untrained subjects is particularly relevant. But again, just simply don't know, just additional context to keep in mind.
That's a really good point. I was literally just going to say, I don't think the training status would influence the directionality of these findings. I still generally hold that opinion, but I think that's a really interesting point. Kind of gets my mind thinking about, you know, periodization for hypertrophy, exercise selection, muscling, all that kind of stuff. But you know, that's taking this stuff that, as we've talked about, is still definitely not black and white, definitely not strong conclusions, and then making additional leaps in you know, kind of the logic train there. The last thing I have to say, and I think this is actually a really important point, and Zach alluded to this a little bit more, is that if we kind of take this general body of research, I think this is a good example of how kind of the acute sensation of an exercise is not a great proxy for what's most effective in terms of longitudinal hypertrophy outcomes. Like if you were to compare in the Pedrosa study, right? If you were to compare that group just doing the top half of the range of motion compared to the bottom half, I would guess that if you were to just ask the subjects which one feels more effective, they'd probably say the top one. That would just kind of be my guess. And I think, you know, if you were to do, you know, some sort of bicep curl variation where you get a really good contraction at the top and it just feels really good, like that feels like you're doing something, you see the muscle, you know, you kind of see the muscle shorten and you see the muscle like visually get bigger. It just feels good. It feels like it's more effective. But based on these studies, it's actually kind of the opposite. And I think that's just a good example. And the way I like to frame it in practice, because I will still ask athletes like, hey, where do you generally feel this? Like, where's the sensation, that kind of thing. But that's only when kind of the constraints of the exercise are held constant. So in other words, if you're doing an RDL to the floor and your starting point and ending point is constrained, right? Slight deviations in execution. If those lead to a slightly different sensation, I would venture to guess that kind of the muscles taking the tension, you're going to be able to experience that difference. But if you were to compare like the preacher curl and Sato, the bottom half compared to the top half probably feels a little bit better, but we saw that the bottom half is more effective. So I think that's just important to kind of chew on. Cause I think that's a very, very practical thing, that people obviously deal with on a day-to-day basis. But yeah, I just think that's important to underscore.
Cool. I got two more things. Well, first one is, this is just a question. Do you think it would be best to kind of get theoretically the best of both worlds? What if we utilize like a short exercise where the failure point's at a short position? So I'm thinking like a spider curl, for example. And then you just went to failure of the most lengthened position. Like we've talked about this a couple of times, but I'm just trying to think now, like if we had a failure point throughout the entire range of motion on the way down, as opposed to either
so
or,
like,
if that
like
makes
length,
sense.
Lengthened partials, like we've talked about.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, pretty much.
So
yeah,
if you fail a dumbbell spider curl, you're going to fail at about 90 degrees of arm flexion, which is, you know, a relatively short muscle length because your shoulder is also flexed there, kind of whatever, short to moderate. It's hard to say for sure. But what Zach is saying is you keep going, even though you can't get all the way up to that failure point until your failure point is at the bottom. Yeah, we've talked about that in the past. I think that makes a lot of sense, if I'm being honest.
And the reason I bring that up is because I would need to think about this more. Definitely, I'm kind of just spitballing here. But technically, the way that failure is being defined is also being manipulated. And I've heard a little bit of chatter on this on social media. Is like, let's say we take two exercises and we take them to the same. So I guess that cable curl example is good. If we could somehow manipulate the one, just do those lengthened partials at the very bottom with a cable curl, but then we had the other group that did full range of motion reps, but then went to failure at the lengthened position. Does that give us any sort of comparison? Honestly, I don't know. And I don't even know if that makes sense. It's just something I thought of right now.
It would just be the cable curl, preacher curl, like they did, you know, go to failure until you can't complete the full range motion compared to doing that and then adding some length and partials at the end. Is that what you're saying?
Pretty much. It sounded way cooler in my head when I was when I was thinking about the comparison. Because that makes it seem like obvious that the other group would do better. But yeah, I'd have to chew on that some more. I don't really know what I was saying. But basically, the concept there that I think is important to chew on is that, okay, we have the muscle length you're being exposed to. We have the failure point of the exercise's range of motion. We have total range of motion, but then we also have the way that failure is being defined is contingent on the exercise that you're doing. And so that technically could be also controlled for between the same, you see what I mean? Like that's another variable. But I don't know if that would even make sense in a research design to examine. Could do a third group, I guess, something like that.
Yeah, get pretty complicated. I think this whole discussion makes me excited about like some of the technology that can influence the resistance curve and kind of match it to your strength curve and influence. Obviously, the muscle length is determined by the start and end point of a range of motion. But if that can manipulate the failure point, muscle length, and if we learn more about that, you know, maybe 10 years from now, you could potentially optimize things on a per set basis pretty well.
Yeah. The only other thing that literally just made me think of, but I'm going to cut us off here, cause we could go on this on another 20 minutes on this. there's a lot of theoretical mechanisms for why long muscle lengths seem to be important. Passive mm-hmm. tension, whatever you want to say. Like, there's a ton of different things that people have kind of speculated on why this is important. Although just like purely subjectively from like a training perspective, like me doing it, it does make me take eccentric overload with a little bit more kind mm-hmm. of credence now. Cause I feel like that's like subjectively pretty similar. And so mm-hmm. what if you do a long muscle length exercise, but you also have an implement that allows you to do eccentric overload with that, to which that stretch or whatever is now absolutely maximized to a really large extent.
So like a flywheel cable curl facing away from the cable stack or something like that.
Something gnarly like that. Absolute tendon shredder.
Yeah, that's yeah, man. Like those things wax me. I've used those a couple times at like conferences or something like that. Just done like a set, just go hard, because you know what else would you do if you're at a conference and then like literally cannot move my flex my arm the next day from doing a set of bicep curls. I could only imagine doing like some sort of advanced technique. Yeah,
think of like a multi-joint movement doing that, like RDL or something. Oh man.
Yeah. No, I don't need any more eccentric overload on those, dude. Like those things zap me. Being 6'4" and doing RDLs to the floor, like you only need a set or two. But no, just this is kind of a side point. You know, we got asked on a podcast a while ago, like, you know, do you think that 5 years from now, the way people train is going to look totally different? Or do you think we've kind of, you know, reached that inflection point in kind of the evidence-based community? Okay. We kind of know it works, right? We have the general tenets for frequency, volume, intensity nailed down for strength and hypertrophy, yada, yada. I don't know, man, like we have so much to learn about just this little topic of muscle length and muscle length at the failure point. We're gonna know so much more a year from now, five years from now, let alone 10 years from now. This is the kind of stuff when you dive into a body of research that is emerging, that makes you really optimistic, because you have decades of research ahead of you when you think of all these little small nuanced points that we talked about that aren't going to be investigated for a while, because there's so many other questions that need to be answered before you can get to those. Right. We talked about the interplay of microcycle design. We talked about the interplay of proximity to failure. We talked about different, right? Once you kind of get these general concepts, maybe there's a bunch of studies done on the quads. Now you got to do it for the other, the other muscles as well. So yeah, man, it's exciting because there's a lot more to learn, in the coming years.
Totally agree. The last thing I want to wrap up with before we finish up is, we'd be remiss to talk about this topic and not shout out our good friend. Milo Wolf is doing his PhD on this topic, so we'll definitely get to learn more on this, and I'm excited to see their kind of investigation of this further. He's done he's doing some cool surveys on this now. I'm sure that'll be informative, and then we're kind of looking forward to see what he finds. So,
maybe we should, especially if he thinks we butchered something here, have him sure he'd have some. I'm sure he's thought about this more than we have. So
100%. Yeah, cool. No, I think we should do that. But yeah, I think that's pretty much everything we got. As Josh said to start the show, if you don't mind, go ahead, give us a 5-star, I think is still in the stars metric system, rating and review on podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and check out the description for everything we offer, including a Q&A form for upcoming episodes, so we can have some more questions from you guys to answer. And without further ado, we will see you next time on the podcast. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Take care.
Thanks, everyone.